Hi Sharks, मेरा नाम सुलह है. I'm 27 years old and I'm from Ahmedabad. Sharks, आज मार्केट में बहुत सारे प्रोडक्ट्स ऐसे अवेलेबल है which make you feel great on the outside. लेकिन अंदर का क्या? Yes, I am talking about your Chaddi Buddy.
Hello everyone, today I speak to Suley Lovesy, the founder of Bummer. Bummer is on a mission to disrupt the millennial-focused underwear market. So in this exciting episode, he talks about his amazing journey from not being taken seriously in the early days to his dramatic appearance on Shark Tank India. He shares brand-building strategies and talks about marketing to Gen Z and millennials, talks about pricing philosophies, spotting a gap in the market, spending 2 years on R&D, and finally he talks about his life-changing trip to America, and much, much more. So please enjoy the show. Thank you. Hello, Suley. Thank you for coming on the Indian Startup Show today.
Thanks, Neil.
Please tell the listeners what you do.
So, Neil, I run this really cool underwear brand called Bummer. We're a direct-to-consumer underwear brand. Started roughly about 24 months ago. Mm-hmm. We make really fun underwear for underwear and loungewear, actually, for the Indian market, primarily catering to the 18 to 24-year-old, 34-year-old millennials and Gen Z of India, men and women both.
Awesome stuff. First question, why underwear?
I think it's a very interesting market, right? If you think about it, right? It's practically a product of apparel that every single human being wears, right? But at the same time, so little attention is paid to a product like this. Mm-hmm. It's so commoditized, right? And I think that's why it's been so interesting for us over the last couple of years, right? Every single more than a billion people in India and everyone kind of wears underwear, and yet so little innovation, so little design change, or so little design change. I think that's where we saw our gap, right? So we kind of started off with Bummer with that mindset that we could actually build something for the Indian millennials and Gen Zs. You don't want your 60-year-old dad to be wearing a white underwear versus also your 18-year-old kid wearing the same old white underwear, right? If you're seeing innovation in t-shirts and hoodies and trousers, why not your underwear, right? I mean, that was the very simple perspective about why we wanted to build for underwear.
Cool. Like you say, you started 2 years ago. How did you get this off the ground? Obviously, you must have done some R&D.
So I think it's been about 2 years since we've been sort of operational. But there's close to about 13 months of R&D which went behind the scenes. And I think what the biggest hurdle of getting this off the ground has been the product side of things, right? It's so difficult building a product that is 100% custom made at this point in time, with primarily our own designs, our own materials. The material is essentially the core of what we do, right? The general user's perspective is that underwear is always supposed to be cotton, right? And we make our underwear out of out of micromodal fibers.
Right.
They're 100% sustainable in nature. The printing process on them is so complex. The garment process is so complex. So I think we spent the first about 12 to 13 months of it primarily figuring out how do we build a great product, right? And I don't think we delivered 100% product when we actually launched the brand, right? I think it was very important that as a brand, you just launch with something you have, which is decent, sort of like your MVP, I would say,
yeah.
and try to at least assess the market for the first 6 months. And that's what we did, right? So yeah, I mean, the R&D was intense. I had one employee at that point in time who was kind of helping me with sort of everything, or like an all-rounder employee, I would say. Mm. And building the product was the biggest challenge, I would say. But I think now we had a very settled supply chain. We're building a kick-ass product, I would say. I would like to believe at least. So that's how the 13 months went, branding and building the brand up, designing collections and getting the product right. That's primarily where the 13 months sort of went out before we actually even got to market.
Cool. I assume you must have had like some assumptions during the research and development of this. what went right and what went wrong in terms of your assumptions?
Yeah, I think the biggest assumption here is when you're building for apparel, right? The biggest assumption you can make is about the trends and the design of what a consumer will adapt, right? When you're a brand that's not even present in the market yet, you build your first collection based on what you feel is cool, right? Like you feel, okay, this might work in the market. You'll reach out to a few friends and family and you'll try to assess, hey, is this nice or not, right? And you'll build your collection based on that. But I think when we launched our first collection, I think we were in the completely wrong track. Mm. I think we were not doing the right thing. We were not building the right designs. We were not building the right colors across our product range. And I think what has really helped us over the last couple of years is the fact that we don't build based on gut feeling anymore. Right. We build based on what our consumer tells us now, right? Every single day, there's hundreds of calls that go out to our consumers to try and understand, hey, what do you like? What exactly is something that you would like to see from Bummer in the future, right? And building based on that makes so much sense now that you actually have a certain sense of lowering down on your risk, right? Mm. And I think that's only something that you can probably do after you launch your first collection and you have so much feedback from so many people coming out and telling you that, hey, I would love to look at this. I would love to look at a print like this. I would love to look at a color like this, for example, on your underwear. And we build based on that. And at this point in time, there's like a very equal sales split between all the prints, all the colors that we launch in our market, because consumers practically end up loving everything that we build because we're building primarily on their feedback anyways, right? So I think, yeah, that's super important and something we've kind of taken up on a day-to-day basis for us.
I suppose like 13 months, that's quite a long time.
Yeah.
What you're doing.
Yeah.
Would you change anything looking back? You know, would you like test it a lot more quickly, you know, get it in the as soon as possible, as it were?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think the biggest challenge here, Neil, is that when we were starting out, right, there was so little knowledge, right? Like, I mean, I would like to believe that I also lacked so much more knowledge, right? And when you're starting off like that, it's very important that you can go out and learn a bunch of stuff for yourself as well. Having said that, I think the primary focus was that while it took us close to about 12 to 13 months to get the brand and the product off the ground, I could do it way more speedily at this point in time because now that network is established, now that supply chain is established, now that knowledge of the product is established, right? So I think, and this is one of the core challenges of being a solo founder as well, right? I mean, if I had a co-founder, for example, who had immense knowledge about the product, for example, I could have done this these 12, 13 months in less than about 6 months, right? Because then that person could have brought so much more knowledge about the product. The reason why it took 12 months is because I was learning as I was going. And I think that's very important as well, right? Because now looking back at that time, I feel that, hey, how did I not know about this? Like this is something so simple and so basic, right? So I think that really definitely drove a lot of impact, in my opinion, in the learning curve while we were starting Bummer.
In terms of marketing, how did you market the product in the early days? You know, what worked? Was it paid, yeah, or non-paid, so, organic, etc.?
Yeah. So I think primarily when you're starting off, right, I think paid marketing is the way to go. Because establishing the brand organically is something which is very difficult to do in the market, especially when there's so much content running around in the Indian ecosystem. So paid marketing was definitely, for the first 12 months, I would say the paid marketing was our primary driver of revenue at one point in time. And I think what really changed the scenario from paid marketing to organic marketing was us featuring on Shark Tank, right? Because there's lakhs and crores of millions and millions of people who are actually viewing the show overnight, and that really enables us to get into a situation where there's so much organic traffic for the brand and for how we are positioned as a brand. Mm-hmm. So paid marketing, I would say, acted as a leverage.
Yeah, let's talk Shark Tank then. What apply in the first place?
I think more than the funds, right, Neil? It's more than getting a deal on Shark Tank, more than getting the money in the bank. Mm-hmm. I think more than any of these things, Shark Tank was primarily a focus on how do you get in front of millions and millions of people without having to spend a penny, right? So it's definitely an awareness play, But at the same time, I think the capital that you end up raising also, right, is so relevant, because we ended up raising capital from someone like an Aman Gupta, who's the founder of Boat Electronics. They're like a D2C giant in India. Mm-hmm. Someone like him had so much more value, more than the money that he brings to the table anyways, right?
Well, what was the reaction when he got through then, when he got the email, you're going on Shark Tank?
I think, I was jumping through the roof, to be honest. The first thing I probably did was like call up my family, right? Like call up my mom and dad and you know, kind of tell them that this is what's happening, right? Even at that time, and even before I went into the tank pitching to these guys in front of the cameras and everything, the focus always was, right, like, let's do a solid pitch. Whether we get the deal or not is like completely secondary. It's completely secondary. I think as sharks, as successful entrepreneurs, they need to see that I'm passionate about what I'm doing. Like, that was the focus, right? That I'm eat, sleep, and breathe what Bummer does. Mm-hmm. If that's a message that you can get across to them through your pitch, then they will believe in you somehow. That really helped a lot. I don't know if you've gotten a chance to see the episode.
And on the actual show, it did get a bit heated at the end. I think the guy at the end of the row, I don't know his name, but yeah, with the glasses, I think I don't know what he was complaining about. He absolutely slaughtered you.
Oh yeah, for sure. I think it was, I mean, I was so nervous at that point in time, right? Because as an entrepreneur who's sort of just starting out, right? Yeah. You've never really been in front of so many cameras, so many lights, such influential people in the ecosystem, right? And that kind of takes a toll on you, right? So I feel that was definitely very impactful, very impactful. But I think what was also important is to not move away from what I believed in. Mm-hmm. I think when Ashneer kind of said that, Ashneer is the guy who founded BharatPay, mm-hmm. I was very clear when I went into the tank that I wanted to raise capital, not for the sake of raising capital, but for the sake of raising capital from people who could actually help me in the long run. Now, someone who's building a tech business or a fintech business, for example, would have very little value addition for me in the long term, because I'm building something in the D2C space. So one of the core challenges that actually bothers us at Bummer is, how do you manage inventory, for example, or how do you better plan inventory, for example? Now, these are challenges which a tech business or a fintech business would never really know how to tackle. So I was very clear when I went in there, and I was like, I want to raise capital from these two guys, because they've been in the D2C space, and then they know how to tackle the environment. And I think after that, it was just great, right? Because Aman then realized that, hey, I can actually help this guy. And which is when he came out and said that, I want to make an offer to you, which was like, just at that point in time, it was just, I was like super elated that someone is actually, a shark is actually willing to make an offer. And then we kind of negotiated it down and kind of reached a certain set of valuation that would be mutually agreeable for both of us.
Yeah, talk about that. Because in the end, I think you were like haggling over like 1 or 2% or something at the end. It did make for great TV, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I think for the Sony team, it made like, for the Indian television team, it made like a lot of sense, right? But I think, so to be very honest with you, the actual shooting in the tank is roughly about 40-45 minutes, or even more actually for a few brands, right? What they show you on TV, it's practically only the 15-20 minutes of it.
Yeah.
And I think I really wanted to battle for that even 0.5%. The reason being, because I know that as a brand, we're going to need cash from time to time, ideally anywhere from about 8 to 12 months, every single 8 to 12 months, we're going to have to go out and raise capital. As a founder, it's so important for us to retain the equity that we value, because at the end of the day, this is our baby, right? Like, investors will come and go, right? They see a fruitful exit and they'll probably bounce off, right? But as a founder, it's so important to maintain the level of equity that you can maintain. And so for that reason, I think at the end of the show, that 0.5% was also so important, right? Because when you go into further rounds, you get into a Series A, you get into a Series B. Because for us, the next round is practically going to be a pre-Series A, for example, or maybe even a Series A, I don't know. And at that point in time, it becomes so important that that half percent also matters so much. So I think it was pretty important that we argued for that. The Sharks at the end of the day gave in. And I mean, I came out super happy. So I mean, I'm not complaining for sure.
Yeah, one last question about Shark Tank as a TV show. You know, the reaction on Twitter and LinkedIn from what I've seen, it seems quite negative. I don't know why that is. You know, it's a TV show. You know, people want to be entertained. I mean, we have one in the UK called Dragon's Den. You've got the UK, USA, yep. Shark Tank, Australian, Canadian, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, people from all walks of life watch it who probably wouldn't be interested in entrepreneurship. Yeah. So I don't know why people seem to be quite negative and down on it.
Yeah, so I think Neil, the primary reason why you know, there's sort of like a mild negative reaction in the market is probably also because there's a lot of drama happening, right? Like when you look at Indian television, right? and when you look at, I mean, when you look at sort of a Shark Tank from the American ecosystem or from the Australian ecosystem or from any other ecosystem where Shark Tank is actually present, it's purely business, right? It's purely business. You talk business and then that's where it starts and it ends, right? With India, I believe, like, to garner a larger sense of how viewers perceive the show, there's been a lot of drama, right? I mean, quite literally, take my episode, for example, or my pitch, for example. There's been so much drama, just, you know, as a third party or an outsider, you could say that this was uncalled for, right? But it's just been done up that way that could potentially garner more users. And I think it's fantastic, right? I think I'm not saying that in a negative way. I'm saying that in a great way, because now, at this point in time, the Indian startup ecosystem is so phenomenal that even 8 to 10-year-old kids to 60, 70-year-old grandmas and grandpas are actually watching the show to try and understand what is net margin, what is cost of acquisition, what are, you know, just general trade terms, which ideally they would have never known. This drama is actually taking the show to billions of people, which is great. And it's very important for an ecosystem like India. If you didn't have drama, I think the viewership would have been way less. So I think the drama is so good to actually have this show take to so many households that would have probably not viewed it if there was little to no drama. So I think at the end of the day, it's a very smart marketing move. It makes a lot of sense, and I mean, from a brand standpoint also, it drives us value across so many thousands and lakhs and millions of consumers, you know.
Actually, what advice would you give our listeners regarding pitching then, as someone who's pitched in front of national TV, in front of millions? You must have rehearsed that pitch quite a few times then.
Oh yeah, so the process with Shark Tank is, right, like, it's you've to be on set for about 4 days.
Oh wow.
And the first 3 days is where you rehearse your pitch along with the broadcasting partner team, right? Yeah. And then the fourth day is when you actually go into the tank and pitch in front of the Sharks. Okay. So the first 3 days is primarily just you rehearsing your pitch and taking a mock drills, like, okay, these are the kind of questions that the Sharks may ask me or may not ask me, right? So you're sort of prepared when you're actually going in, right? But at the same time, I think what's very overwhelming is the idea that when you're rehearsing, you're backstage, right? It's not a lot of pressure. When you're actually in the tank, it's a lot of pressure because you're actually in front of the Sharks, but at the same time, there's like tens of cameramen who are screening you. There's hundreds of lights like blowing right on your face, for example. And at that point in time, I think if this is a situation you've never really been in before, it's very important to stay calm. It's very important to stay cool. And it's very important to hold your ground, right? As you may have seen, or as many of your listeners would have seen, the sole aim of the sharks is probably to grill you, right? Like to test you at your very weakest point.
Yeah.
And in that situation, if you can still stay strong and be confident that, hey, whether they give me the money or whether they believe in my business or not, or whether they give me the capital to build my business or not, I'm still very passionate about my business and I'm going to go out and do this regardless of the reaction I get from here. That's your winning story, in my opinion. That you, in front of all these people or in front of all these influential people, stand your ground believing that I can do this, right? Like I believe in what I'm building. And I think for me also, right, that was very, very simple, right? When Ashneer came out and said that, you know, this is not right, and he had all these words come out to me. I think it was very simple for me that, I mean, no matter what you say, I know for a fact that I'm doing something good with what I want to do, and I'm going to continue building it whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
So that's something that was very important when I actually went in, and then obviously like the other sharks kind of really liked it and they gave me the deal. So pretty much summed up what I actually wanted to do with the show anyways.
Cool. Right, let's move on then. In terms of pricing philosophies then, what were your thoughts on pricing? Did you want to undercut the market or did you go the other way? Thoughts on pricing?
Oh no, for sure. I mean, I don't think undercutting pricing makes sense, right? Especially when you're in the premium market, right? When you position your brand into the premium market, undercutting does not make sense, right? It's a very, very simple principle of, and this was a question they asked me on Shark Tank as well, right? Are you playing the brand game or are you playing the price game, right? And I think price game is not something that you should get into for any fast moving startup ecosystem. To be very honest, if you're playing the price game, then actually just dive right into the price game, right? Build a product that's slightly inferior or at a similar quality as your competitors and just undercut them on pricing, right? That's probably one way to succeed, and it's probably the most challenging way to succeed. But actually for Bummer, the core focus is that I'm not going to undercut my competitors, but I'm actually going to stay very close to you so that it doesn't matter too much to the consumer. For example, if I increase my price by, let's say, like 50 rupees or like 100 rupees, for example, as a consumer, that hardly matters, right? But for that additional price, I'm giving you way more value for money. So I think that matters way more when you try to undercut a competitor and instead you actually try to deliver more value for the same price. So getting into the price game is something which is very ridiculous, but instead try to go head on with your competitor in the same pricing, but at the same time try and deliver more value to your consumers for the same pricing. That makes way more sense to the Indian consumer, to the ideal consumer, than you would if you were trying to undercut someone.
Interesting stuff. And in terms of branding then, listeners, any advice on how would they go about building a brand? Any thoughts and concepts they should be thinking about?
I think as long as you're building for the next generation of Indian users, there's such a large consumption story built in here, and which is really realistically the reason why Bummer even happened in the first place, right? The youth of India is consuming so much stuff online today that there's close to about 40 million millennials in India, and then obviously you could potentially add up another about 10 to 15 million Gen Z users in India. Build for them, right? Communicate in a way that actually resonates to this kind of an audience. Build your design language, build your communication, build your marketing strategies in a way that actually resonates to these kind of people, right? It could be a part of culture, it could be a part of your enthusiasm, it could be a part of a bunch of stuff that you actually end up taking and replicating from the Western culture that's happening across America or Europe or anywhere, right? But these are the people who will become the next consumption story for India or across the world over the next 10 to 12 years. And if you're not building for them, then why are you even building, right? That's my thought process. So with Bummer, it's so obvious that we've tried to take a design language, we've tried to take a communication situation that will reflect how we communicate with the youth of today and how we communicate with our friends, essentially. Like, I mean, I'm a millennial myself, and I would, as Bummer, as a brand, I would communicate with my consumers the same way as Sulai would communicate with his own friends. And if I end up doing that, it's so much more relevant for my consumers to be able to relate with the brand. So I think that's super important when building a branding communication and design guideline.
Cool. And you spent time in America. You did an entrepreneurial course.
I did.
That must have been quite influential in your business.
I think that's practically what changed my life, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was such a phenomenal program. I went to the Masters in Entrepreneurship and Innovation program at the University of Southern California.
Oh, nice.
Took about a year and a half program. Mm-hmm. And you know what the good part is that this program, more than education, it motivates you.
Right.
And I think that's what was most important, right? Every single class, every single lecture, or even your professors, right? They're entrepreneurs in their ecosystem. They've built businesses, they've sold businesses, right? And when you get into a class structure like that, we were over about 60 people in the ecosystem, in the cohort, and there were about 18 countries represented across these 60 people, right? Mm-hmm. So it's such a wide variety of diversity, right, Neil? I think that's one big aspect. And at the same time, being right in the center of Los Angeles, being in a decently great university, I think every single class was meeting founders, meeting entrepreneurs, meeting venture capitalists from Silicon Valley, from the community of Los Angeles. They motivated, right? Because someone has built a $1 billion business in the last 5 years. Someone has built a $100 million business in the last 2 years. And these are the kind of people who come and talk to you as a part of the program. And you feel like, hey, can I do this too with my own self? And at that point in time, I think the structure really changes, right? And that's so more than the education and learning from their story, like learning from their story is super important, but then more than the education side of the program, I think what was most important is what we took away from their story is that I found this gap in the market and I could build a $100 million business in the last 3 years. Can you do this too? Regardless of the geographic or the demographic domain that you could potentially build a business in. And if that's the inspiration and motivation you have, then I think the program was absolutely a big success in my life, I could potentially say.
You must be very proud of this journey so far then.
I mean, for sure. I mean, I think we're barely even there, to be very honest, Neil. But I think we're definitely making improvement when compared to what we were on day one. And you know this, right? Like, because we've been talking for a while now, and you know this, right? Like what Bummer looked like probably a couple of years ago.
That's right.
And what Bummer looks like today. Yeah. And we've made an impact, right?
Yeah. In terms of the business model then, I assume it's an online subscription based model. Any thoughts of partnering with third parties or offline stores perhaps?
Yeah, so I think definitely, Neil. I think for India, I think offline still dominates a large chunk of how business is done, right? Even though e-commerce is booming so big. So at any given point in time, offline is still going to be contributing a large chunk of the business. So that's definitely on the plans. Sometime through the end of this year, this calendar year, 2022 particularly, Bummer is definitely bound to go offline. That's a given fact. In terms of subscription model, I think the biggest challenge with India is that subscription hasn't really been very successful as a business, right? So we're kind of contemplating, we're still trying to figure out how our LTV functions for users, what the purchase behavior for our users, because we're still very young, right? I mean, only 2 years into the market, sort of.
Yeah.
So subscription is not something that's on the lines as of yet, but offline for sure. Like this next 6 months, I think you should see our product hit the stores, at least a few stores, a few hundred stores over the next 6 months for sure.
Okay, cool. And in terms of worldwide expansion, how big do you want to go with this?
I think the as an entrepreneur, right, the dream is always big. The dream is to become a global brand, right? And that's the same. I mean, I believe likewise. I for sure want to see Bummer become a global brand, right? I think American and European markets sort of are saturated at this point in time. But when we look at it, the international markets from an underwear and loungewear point of view, I think there are multiple countries in the Southeast Asian region which are sort of so untapped. And I see a real potential for Bummer going there. However, there's no real concrete plan into entering these markets as of yet. But what I can tell you, though, is that at least the Middle Eastern market and the Singapore market, these are two sort of markets which we are kind of very actively looking at this point in time and could potentially enter these markets sometime through this calendar year for sure.
Yeah, in terms of manufacturing, then, where are these made then?
Everything's made in India, Neil. Everything's sourced in India, manufactured in India, right from the very base raw material of our fabrics to the garment per se. Everything's made in India. And I think that's one part of the business model that I was talking to you very early on in this conversation, how getting the product right was such a massive hurdle when we were just starting off. Mm. And I think over the last couple of years, we've gotten the chance to work with some phenomenal factories, sample with some phenomenal factories, and at this point in time, come down and narrow it down to a couple of factories who we can so blindly rely on to deliver the right quality of product that we want to. So, yeah, I mean, zero reliance at this point in time on any sort of international countries or overseas countries for our product.
Actually, going back to the early days then, were you taken seriously in the early days then?
Not really. That's the funniest part, right, Neil? I mean, when I started building Bummer, I was 24 years old, right? And I mean, even at 24, there's a bunch of guys who don't really look 24. They look like they're 28, 20, 30 probably, right? And when I was 24, I looked like I was 18. I probably still do look like I'm 18, right? I mean, that's the funny bit, right? But when I was kind of beating so many factories and stuff, no one really took me literally. No one really took me in seriousness that, hey, this guy's actually going to come through with the product. So there are a bunch of times when, you know, I used to just like, when there's a situation like this, my opinion, what I've realized with this problem is that even if you look young, you are actually young. And people don't, like people from the industry don't end up taking you seriously. I think what's very important to show them is that no matter your age, you're dedicated to your brand, right? Like you're serious about what you're doing. You're very vocal about what you're doing, right? And I think that's one aspect of your life that can enable them to take you seriously. So I used to practically go down to factories and like meet with 40, 50 year old dudes who used to run the factory. And they never really took me seriously, right? Because I was going there and saying, hey, I want to make 5,000 pieces of pairs of underwear. And they were like, what's 5,000 units, right? It's practically nothing, right? For a larger factory. But spending 12, 15, 16 hours on the factory floor and just trying to figure out, hey, how can we make this product right? And you do that consistently over a period of time. And then they actually start seeing the value in you and saying that, hey, this guy could probably be actually serious about making this, right? And so, yeah, I mean, over the 13 months that I spent building the brand, getting the product right, I probably made no less than 30, 40 trips to the factories, sat there through day in, day out, and, you know, kind of just tried to prove to them that I'm actually serious about doing this. And probably towards the end, that's what sort of helped me get the product out from these factories anyways, right?
Yeah, what excites you most then about what you're building?
I think something, Neil, I tell everyone, right, who's kind of become a part of the company and at this point in time in terms of our payroll structure and who kind of anyone who ends up coming on board, right? One thing that excites me most is not it's got nothing to do with what we're building, right? It's got nothing to do. Like as stupid as this may sound right now, it's got nothing to do with what we're building. It's the question of the fact that I don't like Bummer. I don't think Bummer is good. I don't think Bummer is great. I have over the last few years, I've gone into fall in love with what I'm doing, yeah. Right? And this is something that I tell everyone who's joining the company, who's becoming a part of our organization, that don't like the company, don't feel good about working here, don't treat it as a job, don't treat it as whatever it is. End up falling in love with what you're doing. End up falling in love with the company, end up falling in love with the brand. The work will follow, the processes will follow, right? So I think falling in love is so important, because at the end of the day, this is sort of like a marriage, right? It's sort of like a date. It's a marriage. It's a lifelong relationship, to think of it. You cannot succeed if you don't fall in love. And I've fallen in love, right? Like I've fallen in love since day one. So I think when I think of it in that aspect or that analogy is when it keeps us and me pushing every single day that we could potentially make this happen, right? And so, yeah, I mean, that's probably one of the primary reasons why it's so exciting every single day, because I've already learned how to fall in love with the brand. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's probably one very important thing I want to try and tell everyone who's end up working with us over the period of time.
Cool. Are you hiring at the moment?
I am hiring rapidly. I'm hiring rapidly at this moment.
How's that going?
It's tough, right? It's tough. Being a small company, we're a team of about 20 people at this point in time. So primarily, you know, kind of recruiting myself in a bunch of areas, or especially in the technical areas. Mm. It's been tough, right? Especially when you're from a tier 2 city in India, which we are, Ahmedabad, not really, you know, you will not have access to the kind of talent that ideally a Mumbai or a Delhi would have. Mm. So finding the right talent has been tough, but we're still making do. I think we have some kick-ass people on board, mm-hmm. and we're hiring across the board. Even if that means getting people to move to Ahmedabad from tier 1 cities like Mumbai, Delhi, Bangalore, for example, then we're okay to do that, yeah. Right? We're okay to match salary standards or pay grade standards that ideally a tier 1 city would offer, because at this point in time, that's the kind of talent we require anyways, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're doing that tough process, closing in on a few people, still a few positions that are very, very wide open. And, you know, if anyone's listening to this, feel free to kind of come out to us and apply for sure.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of the technical side of things, like the website and the e-commerce mm-hmm. back end, is that something you've mm-hmm. built yourself, or is that have you outsourced that?
Yeah, so I think a bunch of stuff is outsourced for sure. Mm-hmm. So like the design language and the communication aspect of the website, or the UX flow of the website, definitely comes from our side, from our internal marketing team. Yeah. But coding side of things, the technical side of things is definitely outsourced mm-hmm. At this point in time. We work with a fantastic team who has built across Shopify. And I mean, in my last 2 years of working with Bummer, I don't see a better platform than Shopify for an e-commerce site mm-hmm. to be work on, right? So very happy with how our platform is built. Very happy with how our analytics is built at this point in time. So yeah, primarily outsourced, but a bunch of inputs do end up coming in from our team at the end of the day.
What's your role as a founder like now then, compared to 2 years ago?
So, I mean, compared to 2 years ago, very different, right? Because, I mean, 2 years ago when we were just starting out as 3 people in the company, we were obviously still picking and packing orders ourselves, right? And at this point in time, I think, Neil, it's primarily become more about strategy and hiring and getting the right people on board, right? I think I'm so bullish on team that you could potentially end up spending a few million rupees on marketing spends and et cetera, and doing a bunch of stuff bunch of stuff. But that may or may not result in exponential growth for you over time. I think what will result in exponential growth over time is building the right set of people who want to work with you, and as I rightly, as I said previously, who end up falling in love with the company, right? So my core focus over the last couple of months has primarily been on getting the right people on board, working primarily on strategy, and getting people, more importantly, getting people who will end up falling in love with the company, right? So that's a tough job. That's a tough job. But I think we've found a couple of people who've aligned with that thought process, and we'll continue hiring people with the similar thought process whenever we meet them across the journey of building Bummer.
And in terms of expanding the product range, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, for sure. So very immediate expansion happening right now, to be honest. So we were primarily always an underwear brand over the last couple of years. And so at this point in time, we're getting into two new categories. One is pajamas for men and women, and the second one is bralettes for women. So these are two new categories which are actually happening as early as next week. They should be live on our website very soon. They're made from 100% sustainable materials and come in the same old quirky, fun printed designs that your regular Bummer undies come in.
Yeah, last few questions then. Any advice for our first-time founders? What should they be focusing on?
Yeah, for sure. I think I'll take a very real-life example from myself, right? I wasn't very keen. I wasn't very sure if I'll actually go through and come out with Bummer, right? It was an idea on a pen and paper, or even an idea in my head very initially. But what actually makes an impact, why most founders, and you know, you hear so many founders, Neil, you personally end up speaking to so many founders from time to time. What really drives the larger impact is that you carry on day to day. You do not think about what's going to happen 5 years down the line, or 3 years down the line, or even 7 years down the line, right? You care about what happens tomorrow, right? And if that's a passion that drives you, then I think it's very important that you go through with the idea, the concept, the business model that you want to build. So many people just end up giving up halfway because they think too much in the future that, hey, I don't think this is going to work, or I've already put in so much money, I don't think I can carry on. But that's a very long-term picture, right? If you only think about tomorrow and continue building it and taking it day by day, that's what will help you get to a certain scale and a certain level of execution that you want to get to. If you dream about the fact that 5 years down the line, I'm probably not going to make it, I'm going to lose so much money, I'm going to do this, I'll end up doing X, Y, Z, that's not a very good sign for you to be motivated about. So what should probably motivate you is that what's going to happen tomorrow. And if that tomorrow is exciting, then just do it and keep doing it again, repeat it, and keep repeating it every single day till the time that you actually make it. So yeah, that's something that I've kind of very rigorously followed over the last few years. And not that I'm trying to say that I'm very successful or anything, but because we're probably just getting even just getting started, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, at least that helped us at least launch the business, which a lot of very young entrepreneurs don't even end up doing, right?
Yeah.
So at least getting into that execution stage is so important.
Cool. Last question then. For people who want more information on you and Bummer, what must they do?
Just hit us up. Find us on LinkedIn, probably. Find us on our website, which is bummer.in. Find us on Instagram. Find us on LinkedIn. Our website is always open. We're shipping all across India. If you could potentially reach us also on hello@bummer.in, which is our support email ID, and you're from across the world, we'll make an exception. We'll ship orders to you if you just want to get a feel of what we're doing. We'll make an exception. We'll ship out a special order anywhere you are in the world. We'll make it happen. Reach us across channels.
Which city gives you the most sales then?
As of now, Neil, I think roughly about 55% of our sales is tier one cities, okay, which is Mumbai, Delhi, Bangalore, Kolkata, Chennai, and then 45% is sort of tier two and beyond cities.
Is that what you expected?
Yes. However, we are like, month on month, we are penetrating deeper, right? Like, so initially, the first few months, my almost 70% of my sales was tier one cities India. And we've managed to get it to about 55% as of today. So the focus is to, if we want to get to the masses, then we have to penetrate deeper into the tier two, three, four, five cities, right? Mm-hmm. So we're doing that month on month, and we'll hopefully get to like a larger chunk over a period of time, for sure.
Actually, would you get like social media influencers or Instagram celebrities to like promote this?
For sure. So yeah, we primarily work with a bunch of micro influencers. I would not say we work with like really, really big influencers. And my thought process behind this is that a lot of times the larger influencers, the bigger influencers, like we've got like 500,000 or maybe even a million followers, for example, those are the kind of people who are being followed by a bunch of these users just because of the way they look or the way they present themselves, right? It's not because of the content or the brands that they promote, for example. So we've always seen like great traction with smaller bunch of people, even someone who has like 5,000 or 10,000 followers, right? Because then those are the people who actually follow these people for their content or not because they look good. So, I mean, we've done that. I think the ROI is difficult to measure, but still pretty good. I mean, I can definitely say it drives traffic, right? It creates an awareness for sure. So something we're very bullish on. We'll keep doing that over the months to come, and it should result in some positive ROI over the few months at least.
How are you tracking the performance of each ad then?
Yeah, so with a few, right? We sort of give them an exclusive coupon code, and anyone who kind of ends up using that code, we kind of track that this sort of sale or purchase came because of this XYZ person. But yeah, with influencers, it's a very challenging task to keep track of ROI, right? Because at the end of the day, someone has viewed this influencer creating content about, let's say 4 months ago, and now they've decided, now they're at a cycle in their life where they are thinking that, hey, I need to buy some underwear. Yeah. And I'm going to go back and look at Bummer because I saw this 4 months ago on this influencer's page, for example. Now these are instances which you will never be able to drive or measure ROI from. So yeah, it's pretty difficult to be very honest.
Mm-hmm. Awesome stuff. So, thanks for coming on the show today. Much appreciated. Wish you all the best.
Thanks, Neil.
I'm off to buy some underpants now. So, thanks for giving me all the information that I need.
Thanks so much for having me, Neil. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Awesome stuff. Wish you all the best. Thanks to Slay for coming on the show today. And if you're buying some fancy pants, check out bummer.in. Thank you for listening and supporting the podcast. And I shall be back next week. If you're building something exciting, please send me an email, hello@neilpatel.co, or tweet at Indian Startup SH, or go to facebook.com/IndianStartupShow. Love to connect. Thank you and goodbye.